This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The goal of this forum is to make sure that the whole of society is coming together to really ease the pressure on host communities in a way that is also enhancing refugee self-reliance.
That's Catherine Mahoney, global spokesperson for the UN Refugee Agency on the challenge of sharing the burden of helping refugees. Details coming up also. South Sudan President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar have finally agreed to form a unity government. And hundreds of Kigali residents are now homeless as government workers are destroying their homes. We have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. South Sudan President Salva Kiir and ex-rebel leader Riek Machar have resolved to form a unity government by the end of the 100-day pre-transitional extension, despite challenges that remain. After meeting for over an hour today at the State House in Juba, the two leaders decided to fully implement security arrangements by the end of the 100 days. For VOA News, Waki Simon Wudu in Juba reports that Kiir and Machar briefed reporters together in a rare show of cooperation. However, Machar said they did not resolve the issue of number of states and their boundaries.
We are not able to move ahead, but we said let us wait until the Deputy Vice President of South Africa comes, because he was the one working with our committees. We will come and listen to his report. Maybe he will come and help us with the issue of the number of states.
Kerr said they had committed to forming the new government.
We and the guarantor have said after the 100 days, we have to form the government. And if there are other things not done, we will task that government, because that is a unity government. We will task it with the things that are not completed and implement them.
Kiir also says they emphasize that nobody should ever be able to return the country to conflict. Kiir has led South Sudan since its creation in 2011. Machar was his vice president, but the two split in 2013 and a civil war began. They signed a peace deal in September 2018, but have struggled to fully implement it. Pockets of violence have persisted since then. The UN High Commission for Refugees convened the three-day Global Refugee Forum in Geneva yesterday with over 2,000 attendees, including heads of state, refugees from 160 countries, and human rights experts. UNHCR says it's the largest and most important such gathering ever held. Two things the attendees may already agree on. The world's estimated 70 million displaced persons, half of whom are refugees and internally displaced persons, should be able to live in dignity and return home safely, and host countries cannot be expected to shoulder that burden alone. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Catherine Mahoney, a global spokesperson for UNHCR.
The goal of this forum is to make sure that the whole of society is coming together to really ease the pressure on host communities in a way that is also enhancing refugee self-reliance.
Of course, this is especially relevant in sub-Saharan Africa.
Absolutely. I mean, sub-Saharan Africa is home to 6 million refugees. It's home to some of the largest, most protracted refugee situations in the world. Somalia, South Sudan, DRC, Burundi. These are long-term refugee situations where multiple generations of families are living as refugees. Just today, I received a photo of a 7-minute-old baby girl born weeks after her mother fled conflict breaking out in Burkina Faso. You know, so this is the reality that Africans are facing right now. But at the same time, you know, African countries have this long history of welcoming refugees and sharing the little resources that they have.
So what is UNHCR's short take on how to strike this balance?
I mean, I think we have to look at what policies are states implementing that are having a dramatic effect on a refugee's ability to support themselves in exile. So for example, you have new laws in Ethiopia that are allowing refugees to open up their own bank accounts, new laws that are allowing refugees to get work permits. Now, in this situation, you want to have the opportunity for refugees to be able to provide and support themselves, but doing so in a way that is also opening up opportunities for Ethiopians themselves as well. Many people know that Uganda has long been a shining example where refugees who are seeking safety in Uganda get access to land. They also have freedom of movement. They also have the right to work, and they also have the right to open up their own businesses. If a refugee comes in and is able to spend money in local businesses, those local businesses will see this isn't just about taking jobs. This is about living in peaceful cohesion together and the way to move forward here.
This approach certainly challenges the idea that some people have that refugees have no skills and no real way to be anything but a burden on others.
Refugees are skilled workers, they're innovators, entrepreneurs. They're also taxpayers and consumers. So these are people that can enhance capital returns, they can boost innovation, and they ease pressure on the host community when they can contribute to growth and not rely on dependence and aid. The responsibility has to be shared, but at the same time, refugees have a lot to offer host communities, especially from an economic perspective.
I understand there'll be six main themes or domains of focus at the Global Refugee Forum, including education, burden and responsibility sharing, solutions, and protection capacity.
And one of them is a focus on climate, energy, and infrastructure. And it's a recognition that so much more needs to be done to save and protect our environment and to ease the pressure on the host communities while enabling refugees to meet their own energy needs in a sustainable way. You know, only 10% of the refugees worldwide have reliable access to electricity, for example, to light, heat, cook, power their own shelters. So in low and middle income countries, infrastructure, including schools and shelter, health centers, water and sanitation are already overstretched and poorly equipped, not necessarily just to support potential new refugee arrivals, but also the host communities themselves. And we recognize that the responsibility is too often falling on those host communities to provide this infrastructure. So we need to make sure that we're not putting extra pressure on limited resources and that we need to focus on better ways to provide infrastructure while we're advocating to make sure that refugees get integrated into those health systems, school systems, etc.
That was Catherine Mahoney, a global spokesperson for UNHCR, speaking with Adam Phillips in New York. Five of the world's largest tech companies are defendants in a lawsuit alleging complicity in forced labor in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where six children died and others were maimed or left paralyzed while mining for cobalt. The suit was filed Sunday on behalf of 14 families and names Tesla, Apple, Alphabet, Microsoft, and Dell Technologies. Demand for cobalt has surged for the production of lithium-ion batteries for telephones, computers, and electric cars. The DRC produces more than half of the world's supply of the metal. The lawsuit says the children, some as young as six, were forced by their families' extreme poverty to leave school and work in cobalt mining owned by the British mining company Glencore. Glencore has previously been accused of using child labor. Some children were paid as little as $1.50 per day, working 6 days a week. You're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. 15 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. South Sudan President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar have finally agreed to form a unity government. Hundreds of Kigali residents are now homeless as government workers are destroying their homes. And five of the world's largest tech companies are defendants in a lawsuit alleging complicity in forced labor in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Cameroon's military has arrested several dozen men and destroyed over 2,500 locally made guns and weapons the men allegedly circulated on the Central African state's northern border with Chad and Nigeria. The military says some of the weapons were used by kidnappers and suspected Boko Haram fighters. Mokedwin Kinzeka reports from Garoua, northern Cameroon.
A Cameroon military compactor crushes thousands of locally made guns, ammunition, and other weapons the military says it seized over the past 3 weeks from smugglers, hostage takers, poachers, and suspected Boko Haram fighters. Among those watching the destruction is Regine Eseneme, head of Cameroon's Department of Justice in the northern town of Garoua.
Dans la lutte contre la criminalité dans notre région, notamment,
she says by assisting in the destruction of the weapons, she wants to pass the message that there will be no pardon for highway robbers, hostage takers and fighters who are making life unbearable for people living on the borders between Cameroon, Nigeria and Chad. She says everyone should know that the three countries are now working together to stop kidnappers and poachers noted illegally using weapons. Jean Abate Edi, governor of Cameroon's North Region, says the weapons were seized after several raids on neighborhoods and villages suspected to be the hideout of criminals operating in Cameroon and surrounding countries. The Six Nation Regional Bloc, CEMAC, has frequently said a proliferation of small arms and light weapons is responsible for the armed conflicts, terrorist activities and criminal activities taking place in West Central Africa. Cameroon has experienced increasing instability since 2013, when the Boko Haram insurgency first began to spill over from Nigeria. Since November 2016, the country has also been facing a secessionist movement that has killed more than 3,000. Alamin Abdurrahman, a Garoua-based activist with the Trauma Center for Victims of Armed Conflicts, says the initiative to seize and destroy the weapons is good, but that he has been receiving reports that some suspects are tortured.
Il faut s'assurer que la répression se fait dans le strict respect des droits.
Abdurrahman says the government should make sure it is strictly respecting the human rights of all arrested suspects and that they are not tortured or killed. He says if the government uses force on those it arrests with weapons, it may anger their peers to want to retaliate, which will have a spillover on civilians who are already in desperate need of peace. Cameroon's military has rejected the allegations of human rights abuses, saying the military has remained professional and suspects will be brought before the courts. The number of arms in Cameroon was classified as moderate in a 2017 survey on gun policy by Sydney University, ranking the Central African state 99. Out of 178 nations. Over 500,000 arms are said to be owned legally or illegally by civilians, and most owners are along the border with Nigeria, which is porous and poorly policed. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Garoua, Northern Cameroon.
A youth organization in Zimbabwe has joined other non-profit organizations in crying foul over shrinking civic space and saying there is need for urgent intervention. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi has more details.
Prolific Matarutse is with National Association of Youth Organizations, or NAYO, an umbrella association for over 180 youth groups that work across Zimbabwe. He says they are worried that government promises of greater freedoms have not become reality.
We are gravely concerned by the continued shrinking of civic space in Zimbabwe. That is the exercise of freedoms to assembly and association, as seen by the enactment of the Maintenance of Peace and Order, MOPA Act, which is a replica of the Repressive Public Order and Security Act, and the arbitrary blanket ban on civic processes.
Public Order and Security Act is a draconian piece of legislation that the state used to crack down on dissent. It has been repealed and replaced with new legislation that critics argue is no different. Matarutse adds that the United Nations must make efforts to change the situation unfolding in Zimbabwe.
We are maintaining that the United Nations member state to which Zimbabwe is part of must act to reverse the closing and shrinking space for civil society. We are worried by the increasing number of civil society leaders, activists, and human rights defenders that are being charged under various charges, which include subversion of the state.
This comes amid reports of police brutality towards citizens, ban on public gatherings hosted by opposition political parties, and the kidnappings of labor and other civic leaders who take a stand against the government. What's more, Matarutse says, the cases of those arrested take ages to drag through the courts, essentially sidelining those with the political will to point out the government's shortcomings. That leaves people with little choice but to grumble in silence as economic wars and shortages of fuel, food, and water worsen. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
In Uganda, performance horse riding or equestrian sports are known as a pastime for the rich. But in recent years, less well-off Ugandans have started to embrace equestrian sports with the hopes of competing internationally. Halima Tumani reports from Wakasi, Uganda.
Adriko Jackson started working in a stable after failing to raise tuition to complete high school. Little did he know he would represent Uganda in May at the cross-country equestrian games in Gilgil, Kenya.
I grew up in a herd of cattle where, like, when I could take the cattle down to the stream, I get onto the bull back and then coming out and then I chased him. And then I didn't know that, okay, I was preparing myself maybe in the future to start riding our horses like this. So now, again, going out there to compete has built up so many relationships for me.
So Jackson, you're going to trot into it.
Flametree Stables owner Miranda Bowser brought her first 22 horses from South Africa in 1997 to teach ordinary Ugandans like Jackson horse riding. Since then, she says, Ugandans are learning not just to ride horses, but also to perform. With the right support, says Bowser, Uganda could soon compete with the International Federation for Equestrian Sports.
Hopefully their level of riding will grow and rise as they compete inter-Africanly. So there's nothing to say that we couldn't, with the right sponsorship, get a team of Ugandans to go and compete in Zimbabwe or compete in South Africa, or to go to Zambia or Namibia, where there's all FEI-affiliated competitions going on.
The Uganda Equestrian Association was formed in 2016 and became affiliated with the Uganda Olympic Committee just a year later, raising hopes for more support for international competition. President of the association, Kenneth Opedun, says though the sport is growing, there are still some barriers to overcome. Many Ugandans still see performance riding as a sport for rich people, he says, and the country needs a proper national horse arena to gain public support.
So we are planning to do a very serious stable there where we have an arena that is of world standard, and where we also get to invite in more people to come and do riding and what at a lesser cost.
Opedun says they've just one more hurdle to jump, getting certification with Uganda's National Council of Sports to be able to apply for affiliation with the International Federation for Equestrian Sports. Meanwhile, Uganda's jockeys in May will still compete in Kenya against the host and other well-known equestrian African countries such as Namibia, South Africa, Zambia and Zimbabwe. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Wakiso, Uganda.
And talks between Rwanda and Uganda collapsed over the weekend as the two neighbors failed to find common ground on what some call toxic issues that have poisoned bilateral relations. The delegates have decided to shift the task into the hands of heads of state. This was the second ad hoc meeting on the implementation of the Luanda Memorandum of Understanding to normalize tensions. Eugene Wimana has details from Kigali, Rwanda.
After 7 hours of what were called frank and cordial discussions, the two sides have hit a deadlock. According to Sam Kutesa, the Ugandan Foreign Affairs Minister, the next step gets the heads of state involved.
We will consult our heads of state and come back and continue discussion on these issues.
The Rwandan delegation included Olivier Nduhungirehe, the state minister in charge of the East African Community, the Minister of Internal Security, the Attorney General, the Minister of Local Administration, and the Secretary General of the National Intelligence and Security Service. The delegation says Uganda's complications in the discussion made only the talks delay, but with no agreement.
We don't need to multiply our meetings. We don't need to create commissions and or to create this and that. We need just to solve, to have good will, good faith, to solve the issues that our people are asking about.
As this year nears its end, little has changed in the relationship that once was friendly but has fallen into acrimony and allegations of treachery. Rwanda accuses Uganda of harboring anti-government terror outfits and illegally arresting Rwandans. Uganda alleges that Rwanda has been infiltrating Uganda's national security and closing borders. Critics see little chance of normalization of relations since both presidents have met several times with no agreement. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame said he explained everything to his counterpart.
We have evidence, and I have discussed it with my counterpart in Uganda. There are meetings we had in Addis Ababa, have a summit. We met twice on 2 days during the summit, directly, we're talking. I have kept quiet about so many things, but tried to attend, you know, to them, pay attention, do my best, do this, and hoping that the best will come, and it doesn't come.
If what experts call the blame game continues, the Luanda Agreement, which carried the promise of improvements, will remain just in paper. The Memorandum of Understanding signed in a quadripartite summit in Angola was facilitated by DRC's President Felix Tshisekedi and Angola's João Lourenço. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.